transgender individuals and our health care, which is both medically necessary and life-saving.
The memo says that as for current trans troops, their leaders can expel them if they deem them not to be deployable. What does that mean?
It's not clear what that means. It sounds incredibly arbitrary, and there are already military regulations that bar separation based on a lack of universal deployability. So this is completely inconsistent with military policy.
Jay Stranger, thanks for joining us of the ACLU. And that does it for today's broadcast. A very happy birthday to Vesta Gadarz. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Positively Revolting.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Aphrodisiac Fest on Sunday, August 27th at the White Owl Social Club in Portland. The Aphrodisiac Fest is a fun daytime dance party that brings together music, art vendors, and Caribbean and African cuisine. There will be live performances by Wamba World Beat Band, plus music by Afro Music DJs Solo, Margo, and DJ Piz. Again, that's the Aphrodisiac Fest on Sunday, August 27th at the White Owl Social Club, 1305 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo, and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, and you are listening to Positively Revolting, our your Friday morning talk radio. I'm Lynn.
And I'm Ani.
And we are here this morning. Our guest this morning is Matthew Ho. He's a member of the advisory board of Expose Facts, Veterans for Peace and War and World Beyond War, or War Beyond World. I hope we don't get to that point. In 2009, he resigned his position with the State Department of in Afghanistan in protest of the escalation of the Afghan war by the Obama administration. He previously had been in Iraq with the State Department, with the U.S. Marines, and he is a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy. So I think you can get where we're going this morning. We're going to be talking about Afghanistan and that area. Good morning, Matthew. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. You know, so I read your article that's in antiwar.com, Trump's Turn to Lie About Afghanistan, and you wrote it before his speech or whatever we call these things that he does.
That's right. Yeah.
I can't. Yeah, really.
I feel like they should come up with a new term for whatever.
And it's sort of a word salad, but not as tasty.
Right. So, you know, it's not funny, but we have to laugh. And it was a well-written article about, and we will get to those, the lies that have been told about Afghanistan. But what did you notice that what happened was nothing in specific, except that I guess we don't want to give anything away to the enemies. We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military activities, conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables. Well, we'll guide our strategy from now on. What did you think about that speech? Or what it lies
well,
in.
Well, you know, I mean, that point there, you know, with regards to not saying anything about giving away the numbers to the enemies and everything else, you know, that's absolute nonsense. But that is what music to the ears of the generals and the admirals and the Pentagon. They've been waiting to have a commander-in-chief like this for a long time, not because they believe such things. I mean, you know, if you ever have somebody say that, you know, we can't say these numbers because it'll hurt our troops, it'll hurt their, you know, it's an operational security thing, it'll put them at risk. You know, ask them, when was the last time something like that happened? You know, ask them to show to you, when did such a thing actually occur, when stating that 3,000 soldiers were going someplace actually became a problem in the last 70 years. You know, I mean, Al-Qaeda or the Taliban doesn't have submarines and they're not going to, sink a troop ship. What it is that our generals have this arrogance and they don't feel that they have this responsibility to the media to have to report every detail the media asks. And I think that's what that is really about, that they honestly don't believe that reporting the specific numbers is really an operational security concern. But what it comes down to is that they feel it's an annoyance, they feel it's an undue requirement on them, and they feel it's a burden that they necessarily shouldn't have to carry, and that it is just an example of their arrogance that they feel that they don't have to report those kinds of things. And so this type of commander-in-chief, this type of president, is what generals like who are now no longer generals but the senior civilians in our government.
Right. I was just going to ask you about that.
Exactly.
His three top advisors are generals.
That's exactly right.
Or ex-generals.
I mean, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Mattis, who was the Secretary of Defense, Kelly, who's the Chief of Staff, and McMaster, who is the National Security Advisor. And this is very, very dangerous. People may have shrugged this off or say it's not that big a deal, but you know, individual personalities matter. I mean, it really does affect outcomes. If you go back and you look at incidents in history, oftentimes when decisions are made, they're made based on the advice of just two or three people over and over again. If you look at, you go back and look at, say, Lyndon Baines Johnson, his decisions on the Vietnam War, or say, John F. Kennedy. His circle of advisors. It's always just a handful of people. In those cases, always just men, right? You know, and in this case, too, always just white men, right? I mean, just always the same, coming from the same background. And in this case, coming from the same type of mindset, same type of very doctrinal, and this is the point I've been making, in their thinking. These are men who believe themselves to be modern-day legionnaires, who see warfare as a constant state, and who believe their first priority to protect the American empire. And they now have this president who's very easily influenced. You know, another point, I don't want to go too long on this before, you know, you ask another question, but another point about, I think, what people are getting wrong about Trump's Afghan speech is everyone's making a big deal about how he flipped on his Afghan policy, about how before he was a candidate, or even while he was a candidate, he was talking about getting out of Afghanistan. And that's true. But also, too, if you look at what he was saying while he was a candidate, he was saying about how he was going to kill the terrorists, how we had to get, how we were waging these politically correct wars, how we had to dip bullets in pig's blood, how we had to kill the terrorists' families, how we had to bomb their homes, as well as, too, he spoke about how he was going to have the best generals, how he was going to listen to his generals, how he was going to have generals like no one's ever had generals before. And that is exactly what he has been doing. And so the stuff about like how, yeah, he slipped on Afghanistan, yeah, whatever. I mean, he was saying that. That's because the black president from Kenya was in Afghanistan. He was just making his point about that, you know, whatever. I don't think he knew anything about Afghanistan. I think he was just saying that because he just wanted to build a political base against Afghanistan, and that's what Obama was doing. And whatever Obama was doing, he was going to be against, you know, because he was just trying to build a base against Obama. But I think this point about what he was saying about killing, about and letting the generals do whatever the generals wanting to do,
yeah,
I think that's the point that he really believes, and that's who he really is. And I think that's what we're going to have to live with. And I say that, you know, as I stand here in Wake Forest, North Carolina, with my cup of coffee and my cat rubbing up against my feet. That's easy for me to say. But the people of this world are going to have to live with for the next several years.
And to that point, Trump had the line, this absolutely, well, I guess typical for Trump, but unconscionable line from anyone else, about how he's not allowing micromanagement from Washington, D.C. Micromanagement does not win battles. You know, and so again, all power to the generals, stripping any kind of oversight, where he also talks about, you know, how he's already lifted restrictions on what troops can do in the field. What does that have to, you know, if we could elaborate just a little bit more on what that has to say? First of all, you know, I just start thinking about things like international human rights treaties. And how we have already been found to be far afield of them in many instances. Could we just talk a little bit more about why oversight of troops is kind of an important thing when it comes to democracy, et cetera?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. I mean, it is important because, I mean, warfare is an awful, awful thing. I mean, the Romans, you know, and the Greeks used to assign gods to everything, right? They assign gods to gambling and to wine and to the oceans. All the things are outside of man and women's control, right? And of course, war was one of them. You know, anything that was outside of human beings' control, they assigned to it. War, of course, was chief among those. And you see that war is just this breeding ground of unintended consequences. And war, when someone goes to war, it doesn't, and I went several times, and you know, and I suffer for that, and I've been suicidal because of my time at war for 10 years now, and because of the things I took part in, and because of the things I did, and I say that war doesn't change you. War lets you see what you're capable of, and war lets you access the most base forms of humanity. It lets you devolve back to the basis forms of your survival of stage of human existence, right? As well as too, it just lets go forth this revenge cycle of violence. this revenge cycle of violence. And so when that's let loose, as well as all these other things too, I mean, what we do too, human beings are not meant to kill. I firmly believe that. If that was the case, we would not be spending on the average $2 to $4 million a year to train American Marines and American soldiers before they go. You know, that's what we spend. We spend about $2 to $4 million per soldier or Marine before they even get to Afghanistan, right? I mean, a young man or woman signs up for the Marine Corps or the Army, and then we send them to, for the Marine Corps, we send them for a young man who's going to join the infantry, and now actually women can join the infantry, so that's really great. Women are now able to join and go abroad and kill other people, which is fantastic.
Well, I don't know if I feel terribly.
You know?
Right. You know, isn't that great? You know,
yeah. Progress.
Right, yeah. Progress, right? You know, I mean, so yeah. If you're a woman, terrific. You can now go and oppress other people and kill them. What you can do is 13 weeks in recruit training, so basic boot camp, and then another 10 or 11 weeks in infantry training, and then you join your unit and you spend every day training to kill before you go to Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever it is. And that's all you do, is train to kill. So we spend all this time and effort conditioning young men and women to kill, because they have to be conditioned to kill. You have to change their brains. You have to rewire them in order to get them to kill, or otherwise they won't. And we know this. We know this from a lot of research that was done after World War II by the U.S. Army, led by a man named S.L.A. Marshall, on how the U.S. Army and other armies were formed during the war. And they found that most soldiers didn't want to kill. And so the military went into great expense to make sure soldiers would kill in war. And that's why we have this scientifically proven. We have spent billions of dollars to make sure our Marines and soldiers will kill, and we condition them to do so. And this kill reflex stays in us. And that's why we have these massive suicides among, you know, veterans. And that's right. Why our veterans have this massive suicide problem.
So,
but,
you know,
oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I'm just thinking that it dawned on me as you were talking about that. We have all the technology in the world. If what you want to do is kill, see blood and gore and veins in your teeth, if what you want to do is that, there's technology that will take that. What do you think the politics is of training people to do it? Because it's really not necessary anymore. If what you want to do, and I don't want to, but I'm just, you know, putting this out there as a thing.
Yeah, it totally does, you know, and just to make the point, so that's why you have to have this oversight. Otherwise, the killing will get out of control. But the Trump administration, because of Trump and the generals, no longer sees the political necessity of political control of these countries. They just see warfare as a constant. They don't see the need to win the war anymore in a political sense. They just see the empire, the empire of having to always fight these wars on the borderlands.
Well, and they have no objective. What is their objective?
They have no
except getting money for perhaps military contractors.
Yep, that's part of it. So what I think you see is you see guys like Kelly and Mattis. They just see warfare as constant, right? Trump is just going to go along with it because he thinks the warfare is good. It makes him look good. He's a powerful commander in chief,
and he's lazy.
He's a wartime. And he's lazy, and this just sounds good. He's the most most malleable president we've probably ever had, right? So, I mean,
that I know
we
of.
Could right, exactly, and that's what's so horrible, right? Because folks like us could probably go in there and influence him to plant 10 billion trees, probably, if we had an hour with him, you know, if we could get that kind of access. You mean, because he's so but for Mattis and Kelly, their view is that warfare is a constant state, that they are the defenders of the empire, that all this time that Bush and Obama has as idiotic and as pointless and as foolhardy as it was doing counterinsurgency and trying to set up these corrupt regimes, trying to have these elections in these countries, in Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to control these countries politically, that was a waste of time and effort. Let these countries try and sort those things out, give the minimal effort to those things politically, but just basically reinforce these countries militarily, let their militaries do most of the fighting, but basically just let the wars go on, give them the military support they need, just let the fighting keep going. If you can win, you can win, but just accept the fact that these wars are going to keep going, as that is the permanent state of mankind. I really do believe that's how Mattis and Kelly see these things. And you can see it in the way they speak. You can see it in what they have said, particularly Kelly, when he talks about this as a fight for our way of life.
Where's that? What is that?
Yeah, exactly.
I see no end game with these people. I see, yes, as you said, well, that was what the Bush administration brought us. And certainly Obama did not do much to dissuade that policy of endless war.
And the key point, though, that you brought up is all this is sustained by the military contractors. All this is sustained by... So while...
What about Eric Prince in all of this? Where do you think he is in all of this?
He fits in because, I mean, he certainly fits in.
Eric Prince is the... what's the name of his company now? It's not...
Academy is, I believe, what it is now, though I think it may be held under a different name technically.
Because Hellboys,
even Academy. Well. Yeah. I mean, it's all so shady.
So he's a professional mercenary.
He's a professional mercenary.
And he basically has been talking about wanting to take over for us.
Exactly.
Afghanistan. He was talking about having a viceroy.
Exactly. The first time I saw his comments on this was 7 months ago, where he basically, and the way he went about doing this was he went on Sean Hannity's show on Fox because he knows President Trump watches Hannity. And for people who don't know, Eric Prince ran Blackwater, the mercenary company that infamously became so successful because of its work in Iraq until it murdered many people in a high-profile incident in Baghdad in 2007. But his sister is Betsy DeVos, who is
lovely fan.
The Secretary of Education in the Trump administration. But several months ago, he made his plan known by going on the Sean Hannity show because he knows that President Trump watches Sean Hannity almost every evening. And his plan was to take over for the United States militarily in Afghanistan by having literally tens of thousands of mercenaries or private security professionals, as they call themselves, at a cost of tens of billions of dollars, who would, in Prince's own words, rule, who would do the job in Afghanistan the way the British did the job in India a couple hundred years ago.
And he said it like it was a good thing.
Exactly, which is horrifying, right? Which
yeah.
is absolutely horrifying. I mean, because the way the British, of course, ruled India was, by the rifle and the bayonet, was, and that he himself would be the viceroy, that he would be the one.
Well, of course.
Yeah, of course, it's amazing. And it worked. His plan worked because, of course, either the president was watching Hannity that night or someone mentioned it to the president. And this got him in with a meeting with, I believe, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, as well as with Steve Bannon. And then that got them in with a meeting with the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, at which point General Mattis said no. And there is a tension between the likes of people like General Mattis and General Kelly, who, again, see themselves as you know, defenders of the empire, who see themselves as professional military men, who see themselves as modern-day legionnaires. So this idea of for-profit mercenaries is, and also H.R. McMaster. So this idea of Eric Prince is pretty loathsome to men like Mattis, Kelly, and McMaster. So there is this tension, I believe, that exists between the mercenaries and the men like Kelly, McMaster, and Mattis. So I don't know if we'll see anything like Prince's plan coming to fruition anytime soon. Although you do hear from Kelly and Mattis at times saying, we definitely know how reliable, how much we've relied on the private security industry in the past war. I mean, they do understand how important private security has been, and especially how much private logistics has been. But overall, I mean, aside from Prince, the amount of the how much the military industrial complex sustains these wars is just massive. I mean, like, that's the reason that these wars go forward and keep going forward. I mean, the House of Representatives just in July passed the defense authorization for $700 billion, which was $50 or $60 billion higher than Donald Trump's defense request, and that included more than 60% of Democrats voting for it,
which is stunning.
I just want to break in for one second, Matthew, and
remind our listeners that you are listening to KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting. And this morning, our guest is Matthew Ho. Matthew is a member of the advisory boards of Expose Facts, Veterans for Peace, and World Beyond War, and is the author of a recent article in Counterpunch, The Lies on Afghanistan. And we are speaking to you this morning about Trump's recent announcement that, by gum, we're just going to go at it harder and better than ever.
I don't even know if that's what he said.
You know, who knows what he said? Again, word salad. But we did catch the idea that we're doing it, and this micromanagement of politicians over generals, it's just messy. And, you know, all of this... I want to also invite people to call in and join the conversation by giving us a ring at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187.
Do it now. Do it before 8:50.
You too can join in the conversation with your questions and comments on the newest face, the newest turn in one of the longest running wars in our history. So we have been at war with Afghanistan for 16 years. And we've already mentioned there really is no end point. There really is no end game. There's at no point a finish line that any politician has said, oh, once we cross that, we can declare victory. So obviously, I mean, to us anyway, it's obvious that this is a further machination to bolster the war industry. The cost of the Afghan war has already topped $1 trillion. And, you know, what does that have to do? What does that do to our domestic priorities? What does that do to chances for healthcare, education, housing, infrastructure at all? Or say caring for the veterans that have already been sent to wars in the Middle East, many of them sort of intertwining. How, you know, as a vet yourself, you were talking about some of the difficulties you've had. Can you talk a moment about how we treat veterans once they are used in these wars of imperialism?
Well, I think, you know, they're utilized in two ways. They're used to justify more war, and Trump certainly did that the other night. You know, I mean, he wrapped himself in the bloody flag You know, he utilized them to justify, you know, continued killing overseas. You know, don't question it. I mean, we've already sent women over there before to die and be mutilated and come home mentally damaged. You know, and so don't question. We're just going to send more over because we have to until, you know, we have to, because we've already done it before, so we have to do it again.
I remember back in the...
We have to do it for them, you know.
Right. Well, right. I remember back in the olden days when the time of the Vietnam War, and I remember hearing, we can't let all those who have died die in vain. And
exactly.
I remember thinking, I just didn't understand the logic of that. So and that shaped the rest of my life. But the other thing I would like to talk to you about is all the things we're supposed to have done for the Afghan people.
Yeah, which is just
what has happened there.
Yeah, I mean, and it's pretty clear, you know, pretty clear that, and the same as with the Iraqis, you know, I mean, all the great things that we supposedly did for them, whether it be the freedom and the democracy, or the more tangible, the roads and the hospitals and the schools and the it's all a lie. I mean, it's all been a lie. The only Afghans who seem to have really benefited have been those who, particularly at this point, at this 16-year mark, who are on our payroll in some way or another, and who are living in secure compounds. Certainly those who are not in secure compounds and who are not on our payroll have not benefited, are not living in a well-off manner. Now, certainly there are those who are living in parts of the country that are no longer under the threat from the Taliban army that they were in 2001 when we intervened in that civil war. I mean, that's undeniable, of course. But then we can get into a whole conversation about how the fact that we intervened in the Civil War in 2001 and how we basically took one side out of power, put the other side into power, and you know, completely let one side subjugate the other, let one side punish the other. I mean, let one side commit sins against the other that the other side had been committing against it, et cetera, et cetera. But now, 15, 16 years later, after we have spent $100 billion on reconstruction in Afghanistan, which is more than we spent on the Marshall Plan in
Europe.
After the Second World War, if you were to, you know, adjust that money that we spent on the Marshall Plan for inflation, we've spent more in Afghanistan than we had on that. And we know this because Congress, in 2009, appointed a special inspector general for Afghan reconstruction, and the current special inspector general is a man named John Sopko, and he publishes quarterly reports. And that team that he has documented this thoroughly. And whatever he has looked at, it has been found not just wanting, but non-existent. I mean, criminally non-existent. I'll give you an example. American government for years was saying that we have done great things for the health care of the Afghan people. We have just done wonderful things for the Afghans. You know, millions of Afghans now have access to health care centers where they no longer had where they never had health care before. We had this statistic that because of the United States presence in Afghanistan, Afghans had a life expectancy increase of 20 years. That Afghans, before we had arrived in Afghanistan in 2001, their life expectancy was at 45 years of age, and now it was 65 years of age. This is what the United States government was saying up until about 2 years ago. And which most people knew was suspect. No one was saying this was true. And actually, when you go back and look at all the documentation on this, you'll see the people who did that study three of the six people resigned. It was complete nonsense. And the Special Inspector General's staff, when they went and looked at this, of the about 600 healthcare centers we said that we built, they couldn't find 80% of them. 80% of the 600 or so healthcare centers, or whatever the number is, but hundreds and hundreds of healthcare centers are non-existent. We can't find them.
Huh.
And that
they're hiding.
They're hiding, or they are just taking a siesta, I guess, right now.
On a little break.
They're being utilized for something else right now. They're being utilized for as a break room for They're non-existent. They can't be found. And the same thing. This life expert, John Sopko, the Special Inspector General. They said, when he was asked about this life expectancy number in this, Al Jazeera a couple of years ago wrote this really great article, just explaining how USAID no longer speaks about Afghanistan after years and years about always speaking about Afghanistan, about what a great success story, how they no longer speak about Afghanistan. And USAID, the United States Agency for International Development, when asked about his life expectancy number, they said he said it's baloney. They don't have birth rates. They don't have death rates. They were just saying this, and it was based on lies. It's just one big lie, just to keep the war effort going, just to keep increased money for USAID, right? So Congress would increase funding for USAID, right? So so that particular bureaucracy would get its increased funding, because the war is good for everybody. The war is good for the private contractors, right? It's good for the politicians, it's good for the generals, and it's good for the bureaucracies. It's good for all these different groups. There's not just one. When people ask, what's the point of the war, it's not one simple thing. It's just not about money. I mean, it's about a lot of different things. The bureaucrats, and the bureaucratic institutions have their stake in this too. And so a bureaucratic organization like USAID, which is a living organism, if you've never worked in the federal government, like, bureaucracies are like living organisms, like they certainly are, so USAID, and this extends through everything else as well, too. The schools, this thing that we had sent 8 million schoolgirls, because the United States was in Afghanistan, because our soldiers were there killing and dying, 8 million girls were going to school. Complete lie.
Right.
Falsified information. No records of that.
Well, isn't the first casualty in war the truth?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just one continual lie after another. And that extends for, everything. I was actually in Afghanistan when the first Special Inspector General showed up in 2009. And he was met with avoidance by the military, because he was a former military officer. He was a former military general. He's a retired Marine general. So the military politely tried to ignore him, politely pretend to that he wasn't there. And USAID was outright hostile. I remember retired Major General Fields was his name, and he showed up, and they refused. He didn't have computer. No one would give him a computer. He had to basically borrow computers from people. I remember being in Jalalabad and seeing him on the flight line there, on the runway there, walking up to helicopters and planes with his staff, asking where they were going and trying to hitch rides to other parts of Afghanistan, because no one would allow him to request airplanes or helicopters to fly throughout Afghanistan. And here's the man who was congressionally appointed to come and look at, and no one would work with him. And I remember just how hostile USAID was in 2009. And to give you an example why, was at that point when I was in Afghanistan, in the eastern part there, the U.S. military in four provinces, the provinces were Kunar, Nangarhar, Nuristan, and Logman. In those four provinces, the U.S. military was doing $100 million worth of work, right? Roads and bridges mm-hmm. and schools, right? And healthcare centers and whatever. They were spending $100 million. I shouldn't say doing work. They were spending $100 million. And USAID was also spending $100 million. And the two of them, they didn't speak to each other. Like, they didn't even know who was doing what. Yeah, they would not talk to each other. I mean, so it was just this, it was crazy. This goes back, yeah.
I just want to interrupt because we've got some callers who have questions for you.
Sure.
Okay. Jane?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'd rather listen to you talk. I just had a question about Boston Consulting Group. I don't know if...
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know if you read the papers with the Pentagon where they showed the numbers of how much money you could make through privatization, and this is what the British... Well, the British were privatizing. I don't know about India and what Trump said, but the British had privatized currently in modern times, and they were showing the numbers, and I was reading this. My family served... I literally have family members that are, like, locked up. Well, not locked up, but, you know, crazy from the war. Like, their kids mm-hmm. were homeless. And I have a sister that almost died on a two-month waiting list. So it's hard to read any of this stuff. But I'm so concerned for the ideologies coming out of Boston Consulting Group and Mitt Romney. I don't quite understand it. But when I saw, you know, I kind of caught some of Justin Bieber. This will sound bad. But I kind of caught some of Justin Bieber on TV with Ariana Grande, and he was saying all this, you know, lift your hands to the Lord and stuff, and it was just like, afterwards there was this weird commercial from Walmart with a Come Together song singing in the U.S. military, was at Thanksgiving dinner, and it's just like this whole, I don't know.
It's called propaganda.
It's like insane. I don't, and I guess I say that because Mitt Romney owns, he used to own iHeartRadio or something like that. I don't understand this other half of the war myself personally, but I just look at it and I go, you know, who are these other players? And I was wondering if you could explain Boston Consulting Group at all. And
Sure.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks very much, Jane.
Yes. Thank you, Jane. And I'm real sorry that some of the folks in your family are having the problems they are. And I hope they get better. And I hope they get better. And if they're not getting professional help, I really urge you to help get them professional help. And I understand the issues with the wait lists. I can tell you, my VA here, where I have gotten excellent help, but we have about 115-day wait list for mental health care here. So if a veteran calls for mental health care services, if I was to say call as a new patient, I would have to wait about 115 days to see a psychologist.
Holy mackerel.
And I'm the first one to say I have gotten excellent mental health care services here.
Right. Once you
it's
got
a
in.
Question, it's a question of resourcing. It's a question of funding. Yeah. But I really wanted to talk about Boston Consulting Group because that's really important for people to understand. But I do want to touch on one thing going back to also to what Jane said, like iHeartRadio and the media and everything. I mean, this is so important for people to get it and understand. So when I was talking about the life expectancy before, about 4 years ago, because this reminded me of something, about 4 years ago, and this is also too why it's so important that you guys are on the radio and KABU exists and other forms of media, you know, exist, other independent, you know, forms of media exist, and people support independent media. Because when about 4 years ago, The Atlantic published a story called The Best Thing to Happen in Afghanistan. And it was about this story, about the life expectancy increase in Afghanistan. And I read it and I couldn't believe it because it was so wrong, right? And at that point, the only two organizations that were saying that this life expectancy increase had occurred was the U.S. government and the Afghan government. And everybody else, and actually within the U.S. government, USAID was the only one saying it had occurred. The CIA World Factbook didn't acknowledge it. I mean, no one within the U.S. government was saying it besides USAID. Other than that, the IMF, the World Bank, the EU, the UN, everyone else had disavowed this as, you know, poppycock, for lack of a the most polite term I can think of.
It's a good one.
And as I said, the people who did this 20-year life expectancy study, three of the six people on it resigned in protest of the study because the study was wrong.
Right.
And so I contacted The Atlantic and I said, whoa, hang on, the person who did this obviously has some connection to USAID, because this study is complete. And if you read the study and look at the data, you don't even need to have taken a statistics 101 class to see that this is wrong. This is not correct. And again, there's no birth rate information here. There's no death rate information in here. Like what Sopko said later, a couple years later, is absolutely correct. This is baloney. And The Atlantic refused to do anything about it. And I went back and forth. I have a friend who's an editor at The Atlantic. He got involved, and he threw his hands up in the air. And basically what this is there is this collusion that exists, I mean, between the big media outlets, the government, and the war effort. I mean, and this article was a cheerleading article for why we should be fighting these wars, because the war is good. Right, because look at what the war is doing. The war is doing all these good things, you know, by the United States being over there and killing these Afghans.
They're killing off the people that won't live longer. Right? They're killing. Maybe they're just killing off the people that won't live longer. Yeah, that's it. No,
that's right.
I know.
Yeah.
It's completely insane.
Thinning the herd. Right.
Right.
The herd, you know? But about the
Boston Consulting Group.
Yes.
But Boston Consulting Group, yes, is okay. So I'm a. Okay, so say I had not resigned in 2009, and I had, like some of my peers, become and I can exactly give you, because I had a peer of mine who became like this, became
From the State Department, you mean?
Resigned from the State Department, okay. And I had continued on the career track I was on, and I had become a Assistant Secretary of Defense for, you know, Latin American affairs, right? Or for Middle East affairs or Asia Pacific affairs or whatever, okay? And that would have been under the Obama administration. And then Trump wins and I'm out of a job.
Yeah.
So what do I do? I can go work for Northrop Grumman, or I can go work for a think tank, or I can go work for whatever, but I don't really want to attach myself directly to the defense industry like that, maybe. Or maybe I want to do something that has more of a cachet, or maybe I want to get out of Washington, D.C., or maybe, you know, or maybe I want to make even more money than that. And there's this organization called the Boston Consulting Group. And it is a way of working as an intermediary between, say, Northrop Grumman or Lockheed or any other organization, and another party. So I would go to work as Boston Consulting Group, and I have on my resume, you know, that I was a senior member within the Obama administration, that I had previously, you know, I've got, you know, I previously worked with all these people. I've got the credentials. I've got the Rolodex. And I now no longer can represent just Northrop, or I can no longer just represent, one think tank, and I am not a registered lobbyist, okay? Because that falls under, that has legal ramifications, right? I have requirements I have to fulfill. I have limitations. I have reports I have to fill out.
As a lobbyist. Uh-huh.
Okay? Uh-huh. And now I'm just a consultant. So I can do all kinds of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it's hidden where my money is coming from. And the Boston Consulting Group can receive money from all types of organizations, all types of companies, and not have to report it. So it can receive money from a consortium of defense companies, a consortium of intelligence companies. It can receive money from non-defense companies. It can receive money from the Coca-Cola company. I mean, whatever has interest. And then I can go speak to whoever. I can go speak to the United Arab Emirates. I can go speak to Saudi Arabia. I can go speak. I can go on. I can go speak to a congressman.
What a very convenient organization.
No one has to, right? And no one has to register. No one has to write anything down that one a defense industry person came to visit, a lobbyist came to visit, right? A former defense official came to visit. It's all just a consultant came to visit from the very innocently named Boston Consulting Group came to visit. Right. Now, there's a really important, now to top this all off, right, because this is really important for people to understand how this all works. And now this ties back into what you asked about, and I didn't answer it, we really can get into it, but about where we're going with drones and everything, and why that's so scary. There's a reporter named Zai Jilani, his last name is spelled J-I-L-A-N-I. He had some hacked emails that he got a hold of earlier this month for The Intercept. And Michelle Flournoy, who would have been Hillary Clinton's Secretary of Defense, who is at the Center for New American Security, she used to be part of the Boston Consulting Group. She is she helped found the Center for New American Security. That is a Democratic think tank in Washington, D.C. It's almost entirely funded or mostly funded by the defense industry. So that $700 billion that the Congress, the House just voted on for the defense industry, right? A lot of that money then gets pumped back into these think tanks where these people who have romantic ideas, who style themselves as modern-day military theorists, who have these grand notions of warfare, that's where they can then be funded and receive high-paying salaries and be able to afford to live in Washington, D.C. and meet with congressmen and influence people and go on CNN and speak to the Wall Street Journal. That's where they reside, and they get funded by the defense industry. So you see how the circular motion of the money of war works. Congress funds the Pentagon gives it to the defense industry gives it to the think tanks go and influence Congress.
Right.
And
it's
right.
A nice circular
But Zai Jilani early in August for The Intercept received some emails that have been hacked from the Center for New American Security that showed how the United Arab Emirates wrote a check for $250,000 to the Center for New American Security, $250,000, for the Center for New American Security to write a paper, and the public version of the paper came out to 22 pages. So that's what, about $11,000 per page.
If you look at this,
and they're getting off cheap in military funding terms.
You know, and a lot of pictures too. So like, not a lot
okay, well, that's good.
But basically, this paper argued for changing United States law to allow us to export armed drones to countries outside of the United States.
Right.
Right. And Michelle Flournoy, again, who was the head of policy for the Defense Department under Obama, who most people said would have been the Secretary of Defense for Clinton if she had won, receives a check for $250,000 to write a paper that argues for, you know, I mean, it's just basically a payoff, a bribe for her to argue that countries like the United Arab Emirates, which are horrible, you know, on human rights, along with Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and all the other countries, to allow them to buy drones that can shoot missiles and drop bombs. The other part of that, too, is like her main argument, or one of the main arguments, is that because China they're buying drones from China. So then it goes back into why? Because our companies have to be allowed to sell them as well.
Right. Yeah.
So it does. The circularness of this is all there, and it all ties back into what Jane was talking about, the Boston Consulting Group and how that all works. And, of course, that ties really all back into, it all comes back to, and this, you know, back to her family members. And that's what this
Right.
And none of the people there, Michelle Flournoy or any of those people, care at all about Jane's family members.
Right, and the devastating human toll that war has. Yeah. I mean, beyond the profits of the war industry, the profits of the entire underpinning of our economic system and the military-industrial complex, it's the human toll. Also, just want to mention that a listener commented on our Facebook page. You can always like us on Facebook. You can find us there, Positively Revolting. You can also follow along in the Twitterverse, at Positive Revolt. But a fellow commented earlier that he thinks it's all about the minerals in Afghanistan. When they're out of minerals, we'll stop the war, and pretty much not until then. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, there are minerals there. The extraction, I think the Chinese began some extraction of minerals about 5-6 years ago, or tried to begin. I'm not sure where they were at or at with that. I remember seeing a map. I think we first began surveys in 2006, 2007, and certainly people were excited about it. Trump has brought it up. That would certainly excite someone like Trump. But again, there's not one reason. There's not one reason. I believe I'm not a big proponent that we went in there because of the gas pipelines or, you know, the TAPI pipelines that people talk about a lot. I do believe we went in there because of 9/11, that this was an opportunity. I believe that the Bush administration had its eyes set on Iraq, and that we were going to go into Iraq regardless of 9/11, that was going to happen. They really were set on Iraq, and that 9/11 gave them an opportunity that fell into their laps, and that what happened with Afghanistan was a series of events. But that once Afghanistan happened, once we were in Afghanistan, the forward momentum of our presence there, of our ignorance and our arrogance, as well as too, once the money started being made, there was no way of getting out of it. And I remember being at the State Department in 2005 and Hamid Karzai being very upset with the amount of money that was being made in Kabul at that time, with the amount of American consultants that were in Kabul, with the amount of Booz Allen Hamilton employees that were in Kabul, that once the amount of money was there, once the money making apparatus had set in, once that this is a good deal, it wasn't going to let go. Once that money making is there, once that ultimate sustaining thing is there, then the people who see this, whose romantic visions can come true, who believe in all their grand theories, who see war as a permanent state, then the people who you see now on MSNBC all the time, or whether it's the Max Boots or the Bill Kristols or these people who are on the Council of Foreign Relations, these people who live in the think tanks, these people who write all these books, because not everyone is motivated by money. You know, not everybody is motivated by owning a second beach house, or, you know, owning a second house. And, you know, I mean, certainly there are a lot of people who are like that, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area, but, you know, in other parts of the country. But not everybody is motivated by money. There are people who are motivated by power, and there are also people who are motivated by idealism and by their own lofty goals, and particularly people who are in the think tank world who want to be have their theories proven right, and who are want to be
Matthew. We're going to have to leave it there because we have flat out run out of show. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. It is really good to have someone who was actually there and knows what's going on. And I wish you all the best. And thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you both,
Matthew
very
Ho,
much.
Ladies
and
gentlemen.
I really,
We really appreciate your work, and you can find your most recent article in Counterpunch. That's The Lies on Afghanistan. If folks wanted to read more of you, Matthew, where else might they look?
Oh, I have a little blog. I have a small blog at MatthewHo.com.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this morning. A really informative conversation. Good luck with your work, and good luck to us all. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
I want to remind folks that come in right up this morning on KABU at 9 o'clock, One Land, Many Voices looks at efforts in the U.S. Congress to criminalize the growing boycott, divestment, sanctions of Israel movement. At 10 o'clock, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, the Pacific Underground welcomes Portland artist Alex Chu to talk about his recent work and what inspires his style. KABU keeps you informed about all these things and oh so much more all day long, every day. And we want you to become a member. Get involved with your community radio station. Participate and go to kboo.fm. Click on donate. That's how you can do it and be a part of this amazing community resource where we really try to bring you voices to make sense of the headlines and dig deep behind those stories coming out of Washington and other places. With all that, take care. We'll be back next week, and stay tuned right now for One Land, Many Voices.
What would you have instead?
No, this is it.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets